This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, narrated by Suzanne Torin, and directed by T.G. Reynolds and Tiana Kennedy.
Doctors could not pinpoint the physical origin of the various ailments that conspired to leave Frances a semi-invalid. A brilliant woman, Frances once speculated whether the various nervous afflictions and morbid habits of thought that plagued so many women she knew had their origin in the frustrations of an educated woman's life in the mid-19th century. Among her papers is a draft of an unpublished essay on the plight of women. To share in any kind of household work is to demean herself, and she would be thought mad to run, leap, or engage in active sports. She was permitted to dance all night in ballrooms, but it would be deemed unwomanly and imprudent for her to race with her children on the common or to search the cliff for flowers. Reflecting on the number of invalids that exist among women exempted from labor, she suggested that the want of fitting employment, real purpose in their life, was responsible. Seward himself recognized that his marriage was built upon contradictions. "There you are at home all your life long. It is too cold to travel in winter, and home is too pleasant in summer to be forsaken. The children cannot go abroad and must not be left at home. Here I am, on the contrary, roving for instruction when at leisure, and driven abroad continually by my occupation. How strange a thing it is that we can never enjoy each other's cares and pleasures except at intervals." The Sewards' relationship was sustained chiefly through the long, loving letters they wrote to each other day after day, year after year. In her letters, which number in the thousands, Frances described the progress of the garden and the antics of the children. She offered advice on political matters, critiqued his speeches, and expressed her passionate opinions about slavery. She encouraged his idealism, pressing him repeatedly to consider what should be done rather than what could be done. In his letters, he analyzed the personalities of his colleagues, confessed his fears, discussed his reactions to the books he was reading, and told her repeatedly how he loved her above every other thing in the world. He conjured images of the moon, whose silver rays they shared as they each sat in their separate homes, writing the lines that would cross in the mail. He recollected pleasures of home, where the children played in the smoke from his cigar, and husband and wife were engaged in free and open conversation, so different from the talk of politicians. Yet in the end, it was the talk of politicians he craved. As a result, the Sewards, to a far greater extent than the Lincolns, spent much of their married life apart. Chase, too, found himself in a dispirited state in the months that followed the compromise. "Clouds and darkness are upon us at present," he wrote Sumner. "The slaveholders have succeeded beyond their wildest hopes 12 months ago." It seemed as if, temporarily at least, the wind had been taken out of the sails of the anti-slavery movement. Moreover, Chase was isolated in the Senate, the regular Democratic Party having shut him out of committee work and political meetings. Nor could he rely on the camaraderie of the Free Soilers, who believed he had sacrificed them to achieve his position. With time heavy on his hands, he spent hours writing to Kate at her boarding school in New York, where she had been sent when his third wife, Belle, contracted the tuberculosis that took her life. The long years away from home must have been bleak and often difficult for the motherless child. Located at Madison Avenue and 49th Street, Miss Haynes's school held the girls to a strict routine. They rose at 6 a.m. to study for an hour and a half before breakfast and prayers. A brisk walk outside with no skipping permitted, preceded classes in literature, French, Latin, English grammar, science, elocution, piano, and dancing. At mid-afternoon, they were taken out once again for an hour-long walk. In the evenings, they attended study hall, where, without the teacher's permission, one student recalled, we could hardly breathe. Only on weekends, when they attended recitals or the theater, was the routine relaxed. Living 10 months a year under such regimented circumstances, Kate yearned to see the one person she loved, her father. Though he wrote hundreds of letters to her, his correspondence lacked the playful warmth of Seward's notes to his own children. In cold, didactic fashion, Chase alternately praised and upbraided her, instructing her in the art of letter-writing and admonishing her to cultivate good habits. If her letters were well-written, he critiqued her penmanship. If the penmanship was good, he criticized her flat style of expression. If both met his standards, he complained that she had waited too long to write. "Your last letter was quite well-written," he told her when she was 10 years old. "I should be glad, however, to have you describe more of what you see and do every day. Can't you tell me all about your schoolmates, one by one? Take pains. Use your eyes. Reflect. I wish you could put a little more life into your letters." 4 years later, he was still urging improvement. "Your nice letter, my darling child, came yesterday," he wrote. "But I must say that it had rather a sleepy air. The words seemed occasionally chosen and arranged under the influence of the drowsy god." "It will be a great advantage to you to cultivate a noticing habit," he advised. "Accustom yourself to talk of what you see, and to write details, and in a conversational and even narrative style. There is the greatest possible difference in charm between the same narrative told by one person and by another. No doubt a large part of this difference is to be ascribed to constitutional differences of temperament, but any intelligent person can greatly increase facility of apprehension and expression by careful self-culture." The ascetic refrain of Chase's instruction to Kate is that an effort of will can surmount most obstacles, and self-denial can lead to its own gratifications. "I know you do not like writing. You can overcome if you will. I dislike, for example, to bathe myself all over with cold water in the morning, especially when the thermometer is so low as at present. But I find I can, when I determine to do so, overcome my feeling of dislike, and even substitute a certain pleasurable sensation." In his efforts to discipline and educate his daughter, Chase did not spare Kate his own morbid thoughts about death. "Remember, my dear child, that the eye of a holy God is upon you all the time, and that not an act or word or thought is unnoticed by him. Remember, too, that you may die soon. Already 11 years of your life are past. You may not live another 11 years. How short, then, is this life, and how earnest ought to be our preparation for another?" To illustrate his point, he described the death of a little girl just Kate's age, the daughter of a fellow senator. The Monday before her death, he had seen her in the Capitol, strong, robust, active, intelligent, the very impersonation of life and health. A week after, and she had gone from earth. What a lesson was here! Lay it to heart, dear Katie, and may God give you grace. If Kate's school reports were unfavorable, Chase refused to allow her to return home for vacation. "I am sorry that you feel so lonely," he told her one summer. "I wish I could feel it safe to allow you to visit more freely, but your conversations with Miss Haynes have made known to you the reasons why." He urged her to understand. "You have it in your power greatly to promote my happiness by your good conduct, and greatly to destroy my comfort and peace by ill conduct. More often she excelled, relying on her nearly encyclopedic memory and hard work to please her exacting father. If unsparing in his criticism, he was extravagant in his praise. To an affectionate father, nothing was more gratifying, he told her, not even the thought that he might someday be made president, than a beloved child improving in intelligence, in manners, in physical development, and giving promise of a rich and delightful future. He rewarded her with invitations to Washington, visits she vividly recalled years later. "I knew Clay, Webster, and Calhoun," she proudly told a reporter when she was in her 50s. As a small girl, she was particularly impressed by Clay, so tall that he had to unwind himself to get up. At ease with children, Clay made much of me, and I liked him. Daniel Webster appeared to Kate an ideal of how a statesman ought to look, the very words later used to describe her father. He seldom laughed, yet he was very kind, and he used to send me his speeches. I don't suppose he thought I would read them, but he wanted to compliment me and show that he remembered me, and I know that I felt very proud when I saw Daniel Webster's frank upon pieces of mail which came to me at the New York school. Of all her father's Senate colleagues, Charles Sumner was her favorite, as he was of Francis Seward. He was warm-hearted and sensitive, Kate recalled. He was full of anecdotes and was a brilliant talker. When Sumner in turn spoke well of little Kate, Chase was overjoyed. "You cannot think, my precious child, how much pleasure it gives me to hear you praised." Buoyant at such moments with satisfied expectations, Chase shared with her intimate chronicles of his life in Washington. Long descriptions of the protocol followed when a senator visited the president in his office, detailed accounts of dinners at the White House, amusing reports of late-night sessions in the Senate chamber, when all too many of his colleagues have visited the refectory a little too often and are not as sober as they should be. "The sun shines warm and clear," he wrote one beautiful June day. "The wind stirs the trees and fans the earth. I sit in my room and hear the rustle of branches, the merry twitter and song of the birds, the chirp of insects. I should like to have you with me, and we should take a ramble together." Not surprisingly, Kate cherished the prospect of living in the nation's capital, accompanying her father wherever he went, assisting him in his daily tasks. Chase understood her desire, and was careful to assuage her fear that he might remarry and deprive her of her rightful place by his side. Describing a visit to the Elliots, a Quaker family with two remarkable daughters, he confessed that "Miss Lizzie is the best-looking of them all, and is really a very superior woman, with a great deal of sense and a great deal of heart. You need not, however, be alarmed for me, for a gentleman in New York is said to be her accepted lover, and I look only for friends among ladies as I do among gentlemen." Of the four future presidential candidates, Edward Bates was the only one who supported the compromise wholeheartedly. At last, with what he called the African mania finally subdued, he felt the American people might focus their energies once more on the vast economic opportunities provided by the ever-expanding frontier. With equal ire, he denounced both the lovers of free Negroes in the North and the lovers of slave Negroes in the South, believing that the argument over slavery was simply a struggle among politicians for sectional supremacy, with radicals like Seward and Chase in the North and Calhoun and Toombs in the South exploiting the issue for personal ambition. He specifically condemned Seward's higher law supposition invoked to invalidate the fugitive slave law, arguing that in civil government, such as we have, there can be no law higher than the Constitution and the statutes. And he who would set himself above these, claiming some transcendental authority for his disobedience, must be, as I deliberately think, either a canting hypocrite, a presumptuous fool, or an arbitrary designing knave. He exhibited similar scorn for Calhoun, who would shatter the world's best hope of freedom for the white man because he is not allowed to have his own wayward will about Negro slaves. Poor man, he is greatly to be pitied. It is truly a melancholy spectacle to behold his sun going down behind a cloud so black. In the early 50s, Bates still believed that the West could refrain from taking sides, trusting that if we stood aloof from the quarrel and pressed the even tenor of our way for the public good, both of those factions would soon sink to the level of their intrinsic insignificance. His hopes would quickly prove futile, for the settlement was destined to last only 4 years. A human being, the novelist Thomas Mann observed, lives out not only his personal life as an individual, but also, consciously or subconsciously, the lives of his epoch and his contemporaries. If the times themselves, despite all their hustle and bustle, do not provide opportunity, he continued, the situation will have a crippling effect. More than a decade earlier, speaking to the Springfield Young Men's Lyceum, Lincoln had expressed his concern that his generation had been left a meager yield after the field of glory was harvested by the founding fathers. They were a forest of giant oaks, he said, who faced the task, and nobly they performed it, to possess themselves, and through themselves us, of this goodly land, and to build upon its hills and its valleys a political edifice of liberty and equal rights. Their destinies were inseparably linked with the experiment of providing the world a practical demonstration of the capability of a people to govern themselves. If they succeeded, they were to be immortalized. Their names were to be transferred to counties and cities and rivers and mountains, and to be revered and sung and toasted through all time. Because their experiment succeeded, Lincoln observed, thousands won their deathless names in making it so. What was left for the men of his generation to accomplish? There was no shortage of good men, whose ambition would aspire to nothing beyond a seat in Congress, a gubernatorial or a presidential chair. But such belong not to the family of the lion or the tribe of the eagle. Such modest aspirations, he argued, would never satisfy men of towering genius who scorned a beaten path. In 1854, the wheel of history turned. A train of events that mobilized the anti-slavery North resulted in the formation of the Republican Party, and ultimately provided Lincoln's generation with a challenge equal to or surpassing that of the founding fathers. The sequence began when settlers in Kansas and Nebraska called upon Congress to grant them territorial status, raising once again the contentious question of extending slavery into the territories. As chairman of the Committee on Territories, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas introduced a bill that appeared to provide an easy solution to the problem by allowing the settlers themselves the popular sovereignty to decide if they wished to become free or slave states. This solution proved anything but simple, since both Kansas and Nebraska lay north of the old 36 degrees 30 minutes line. The passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act would mean that the Missouri Compromise was null and void, opening the possibility of slavery to land long since guaranteed to freedom. The debate over the Kansas-Nebraska Act opened against increased anti-slavery sentiment in the North. Enforcement of the fugitive slave provisions contained in the Compromise of 1850 had aroused Northern ire. Near riots erupted when slaveholders tried to recapture runaway slaves who had settled in Boston and New York. Ralph Waldo Emerson expressed a common sentiment among Northerners: "I had never in my life, up to this time, suffered from the slave institution. Slavery in Virginia or Carolina was like slavery in Africa or the Fijis for me. There was an old fugitive law, but it had become, or was fast becoming, a dead letter, and by the genius and laws of Massachusetts, inoperative. The new bill made it operative, required me to hunt slaves, and it found citizens in Massachusetts willing to act as judges and captors. Moreover, it discloses the secret of the new times, that slavery was no longer mendicant, but was becoming aggressive and dangerous." Northern sentiment had been inflamed further by the publication of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. Less than a year after its publication, in March 1852, more than 300,000 copies of the novel had sold in the United States, a sales rate rivaled only by the Bible. Abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass later likened it to a flash that lit a million campfires in front of the embattled hosts of slavery, awakening such powerful compassion for the slave and indignation against slavery that many previously unconcerned Americans were transformed into advocates for the anti-slavery cause. Until the introduction of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, there was no signal point around which the anti-slavery advocates could rally. As the Senate debate opened, Northerners were stirred into action in greater numbers than ever, the historian Don Fehrenbacher has written, fighting with all the fierceness of an army defending its homeland against invasion. Passions in the South were equally aroused. To Southerners, the issue of Kansas was not merely an issue of slavery, but whether they, who had helped create and enlarge the nation with their blood and treasure, would be entitled to share in the territories held in common by the entire country. "The day may come," said Governor Thomas Bragg of North Carolina, "when our northern brethren will discover that the southern states intend to be equals in the Union, or independent out of it." This time, Salmon Chase assumed the leadership of the anti-slavery forces. Seward understood that the bill was a mighty subject that required research and meditation, but he was distracted by a multitude of issues and the demands of Washington's social life. With the street doorbell ringing every 5 minutes, the popular New Yorker was unable to find the time to construct a great speech or to marshal the opposition. Consequently, while Seward's speeches against the Nebraska bill were simply essays against slavery, Stephen Douglas later said, Chase of Ohio was the leader. Chase, along with Sumner and Ohio Congressman Joshua Giddings, conceived the idea of reaching beyond the Senate to the country at large with an open appeal of the independent Democrats in Congress to the people of the United States. The appeal was originally printed in the National Era, the abolitionist newspaper that had first serialized Uncle Tom's Cabin, deemed by historians one of the most effective pieces of political propaganda ever produced. The appeal was reprinted in pamphlet form to organize opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska Act. "We arraign this bill as a gross violation of a sacred pledge," the appeal began, charging that a rapacious pro-slavery conspiracy was determined to subvert the old Missouri Compact, which forever had excluded slavery in all the territory acquired from France in the Louisiana Purchase. Passage of the Nebraska Act would mean that this immense region, occupying the very heart of the continent, would, in flagrant disregard of a sacred faith, be transformed into a dreary region of despotism inhabited by masters and slaves. The manifesto urged citizens to protest by any means available. Its authors promised to call on their constituents to come to the rescue of the country from the domination of slavery, for the cause of human freedom is the cause of God. Chase's greatest opportunity had at last come to him, his biographer Albert Hart observes, for in the Kansas-Nebraska debate he was able to concentrate all the previous experience of his life. By the time he rose to speak on the Senate floor on February 3, 1854, the country was aroused and prepared for a great battle. By far the most numerous audience of the season listened to Mr. Chase's speech, the New York Times reported. The galleries and lobbies were densely crowded an hour before the debate began, and the ladies even crowded into and took possession of one-half the lobby seats on the floor of the Senate. In the course of the heated debate, Chase accused Douglas of sponsoring the bill to aid his quest for the presidency, an allegation that brought the Illinois senator to such a high pitch of wrath that he countered, accusing Chase of entering the Senate by a corrupt bargain. "Do you say I came here by a corrupt bargain?" Chase demanded to know. "I said the man who charged me with having brought in this bill as a bid for the presidency did come here by a corrupt bargain," Douglas replied. "Did you mean me? If so, I mean you." Seated beside his friend, Sumner watched with rapturous attention as Chase refuted Douglas's claim that the concept of popular sovereignty would provide a final settlement of all territorial questions. On the contrary, Chase predicted, "This discussion will hasten the inevitable reorganization of parties." Moreover, he asked, "What kind of popular sovereignty is that which allows one portion of the people to enslave another portion? Is that the doctrine of equal rights? No, sir, no. There can be no real democracy which does not fully maintain the rights of man as man." At midnight, Douglas began his concluding speech, which lasted nearly 4 hours. At one point, Seward interrupted to ask for an explanation of something Douglas had said. "Ah," Douglas retorted, "you can't crawl behind that free nigger dodge." In reply, Seward said, "Douglas, no man will ever be president of the United States who spells Negro with two G's." Midnight passed, and the cock crew and daylight broke before the vote was taken, the New York Tribune reported. The all-night session was marked by great confusion, hard words between various senators, and intense excitement in which the galleries participated. Many of the senators were observed to be beastly drunk, their grandiloquence further inflated by too frequent visits to one of the antechambers of the Senate room. When the Senate majority cast its votes in favor of the bill at 5 a.m. on the morning of March 4th, the anti-slavery minority was crushed. "The Senate is emasculated," Senator Benton exclaimed. As Chase and Sumner descended the sweeping steps of the Capitol, a distant cannonade signaled passage of the bill. "They celebrate a present victory," Chase said, "but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself shall die." "Be assured, gentlemen," New York Tribune reporter James Pike warned the Southerners, "that you are sowing the wind and you will reap the whirlwind. No man can stand in the north in that day of reckoning who plants himself on the ground of sustaining the repeal of the Missouri Compromise. Here is the opening of a great drama that inaugurates the era of a geographical division of political parties. It draws the line between North and South. It pits face to face the two opposing forces of slavery and freedom. In the weeks that followed, mass protest meetings spread like wildfire throughout the North, fueled by the enormous reach of the daily newspaper. "The tremendous storm sweeping the North seemed to gather new force every week," writes the historian Alan Nevins. "Resolutions against the law were signed by tens of thousands in Connecticut, New Hampshire, Ohio, Indiana, Iowa, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania." In New York, the Tribune reported, 2,000 protesters marched up Broadway, led by a band of music and brilliant with torches and banners. On college campuses and village squares, in town halls and county fairgrounds, people gathered to make their voices heard. Lincoln was riding the circuit in the back country of Illinois when the news reached him of the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. A fellow lawyer, T. Lyle Dickey, sharing a room with Lincoln, reported that he sat on the edge of his bed and discussed the political situation far into the night. At dawn, he was still sitting up in bed, deeply absorbed in thought. He told his companion, "I tell you, Dickey, this nation cannot exist half slave and half free." Lincoln later affirmed that the successful passage of the bill roused him as he had never been before. It permanently recast his views on slavery. He could no longer maintain that slavery was on course to ultimate extinction. The repeal of the Missouri Compromise persuaded him that unless the North mobilized into action against the pro-slavery forces, free society itself was in peril. "The Nebraska Act took us by surprise," Lincoln later said. "We were thunderstruck and stunned. The fight to stem the spread of slavery would become the great purpose Lincoln had been seeking." Before speaking out against the Nebraska Act, Lincoln spent many hours in the state library, studying present and past congressional debates so that he could reach back into the stream of American history and tell a clear, reasoned, and compelling tale. He would express no opinion on anything, Herndon observed, until he knew his subject inside and outside, upside and downside. Lincoln told Joshua Speed, "I am slow to learn, and slow to forget that which I have learned. My mind is like a piece of steel, very hard to scratch anything on it, and almost impossible after you get it there to rub it out." Lincoln delivered his first great anti-slavery speech in Springfield at the annual state fair before a crowd of thousands on October 4th, 1854. Farmers and their families had journeyed to the capital from all over the state, filling every hotel room, tavern, and boarding house. Billed as the largest agricultural fair in the history of the state, the exhibition featured the most advanced farm implements and heavy machinery, including a world-renowned plow. Residents took pride in what was considered the finest display of livestock ever assembled in one place. Games and amusements, music and refreshments were provided from morning until night, ensuring, as one reporter wrote, that a jolly good time ensued. The previous day, Lincoln had heard Stephen Douglas hold forth for 3 hours before the same audience. Douglas, stunned by the widespread hostility in northern Illinois to his seminal role in passing the controversial Kansas-Nebraska Act, had chosen the state fair as the best forum for a vigorous defense of the bill. Rain forced the event into the House of Representatives chamber, but the change of venue didn't diminish the impact of Douglas's speech. Sharpening arguments he had made in the Senate, Douglas emphasized that his bill rested on the unassailable principle of self-government, allowing the people themselves to decide whether or not to allow slavery into their own territorial lands. The expressive face of the little giant, as the short, stocky Douglas was called, was matched by his stentorian voice. He had a large head, surmounted by an abundant mane, one reporter observed, which gave him the appearance of a lion prepared to roar or crush his prey. In the midst of speaking, he would cast away his cravat and undo the buttons on his coat, captivating his audience with the air and aspect of a half-naked pugilist. He was frequently interrupted by cheers and hearty demonstrations of applause, the Peoria Daily Press reported, thus showing that a large majority of the meeting was with him. When he finished, Lincoln jumped up and announced to the crowd that a rebuttal would be delivered the following day. The next afternoon, with Douglas seated in the front row, Lincoln faced most likely the largest audience of his life. He appeared awkward at first, in his shirt sleeves with no collar. He began in a slow and hesitating manner, the reporter Horace White noted. Yet minutes into his speech, it was evident that he had mastered his subject, that he knew what he was going to say, and that he knew he was right. White was only 20 at the time, but was aware even then, he said, that he was hearing one of the world's masterpieces of argumentative power and moral grandeur. 60 years later, that conviction remained. The initial impression was overwhelming, White told an audience in 1914, and it has lost nothing by the lapse of time. Although Lincoln's voice was thin, high-pitched, White observed, it had much carrying power and could be heard a long distance in spite of the bustle and tumult of the crowd. As Lincoln hit his stride, his words began to come faster. Gesturing with his body and head rather than with his arms, he grew very impassioned and seemed transfigured by the strength of his words. Then the inspiration that possessed him took possession of his hearers also. His speaking went to the heart because it came from the heart. I have heard celebrated orators who could start thunders of applause without changing any man's opinion. Mr. Lincoln's eloquence was of the higher type, which produced conviction in others because of the conviction of the speaker himself. While Douglas simply asserted his points as self-evident, Lincoln embedded his argument in a narrative history, transporting his listeners back to their roots as a people, to the founding of the nation, a story that still retained its power to arouse strong emotion and thoughtful attention. Many of his arguments were familiar to those who had followed the Senate debate and had read Chase's masterly appeal, but the structure of the speech was so clear and logical, the Illinois Daily Journal observed, the arrangement of facts so methodical, that the overall effect was strikingly original and most effective. At the State Fair, and 12 nights later, by torchlight in Peoria, where the debate over the Kansas-Nebraska Act was repeated, Lincoln presented his carefully connected view for better than 3 hours. In order to make his argument, Lincoln decided to begin with nothing less than an account of our common history, the powerful narrative of how slavery grew with our country, how its growth and expansion had been carefully contained by the Founding Fathers, and how, on this fall night in 1854, the great story they were being told, the story of the Union, had come to such an impasse that the exemplary meaning, indeed the continued existence of the story, hung in the balance. for the first time in his public life, his remarkable array of gifts as historian, storyteller, and teacher, combined with a lucid, relentless, yet always accessible logic. Instead of the ornate language so familiar to men like Webster, Lincoln used irony and humor, laced with workaday, homespun images, to build an eloquent tower of logic. The pro-slavery argument that a vote for the Wilmot Proviso threatened the stability of the entire Union was reduced to absurdity by analogy. "Because I may have refused to build an addition to my house, I thereby have decided to destroy the existing house." Such flashes of figurative language were always available to Lincoln to drive home a point, gracefully educating while entertaining. In a word, communicating an enormously complicated issue with wit, simplicity, and a massive power of moral persuasion. At the time the Constitution was adopted, Lincoln pointed out, the plain, unmistakable spirit of that age towards slavery was hostility to the principle and toleration only by necessity, since slavery was already woven into the fabric of American society. Noting that neither the word slave nor slavery was ever mentioned in the Constitution, Lincoln claimed that the framers concealed it just as an afflicted man hides away a wen or a cancer, which he dares not cut out at once, lest he bleed to death, with the promise, nevertheless, that the cutting may begin at the end of a given time. As additional evidence of the framers' intent, Lincoln brought his audience even further back, to the moment when Virginia ceded its vast northwestern territory to the United States, with the understanding that slavery would be forever prohibited from the new territory, thus creating a happy home for teeming millions of free people with no slave amongst them. In recent years, he said, slavery had seemed to be gradually on the wane, until the fateful Nebraska law transformed it into a sacred right, putting it on the high road to extension and perpetuity, giving it a pat on its back, saying, "Go and Godspeed you." Douglas had argued that Northern politicians were simply manufacturing a crisis, that Kansas and Nebraska were destined, in any event, to become free states because the soil and climate in both regions were inhospitable to the cultivation of staple crops. Labeling this argument a lullaby, Lincoln exhibited a map demonstrating that five of the present slave states had similar climates to Kansas and Nebraska, and that the census returns for 1850 showed these states held one-fourth of all the slaves in the nation. Finally, as the greatest bulwark against the Nebraska Act and the concept of popular sovereignty, Lincoln invoked the Declaration of Independence. He considered the Nebraska Act simply a legal term for the perpetuation and expansion of slavery, and as such, nothing less than the possible death knell of the Union and the meaning of America. "The doctrine of self-government is right, absolutely and eternally right," he argued. But to use it, as Douglas proposed, to extend slavery, perverted its very meaning. "No man is good enough to govern another man without that other's consent. I say this is the leading principle, the sheet anchor of American republicanism." If the Negro was a man, which Lincoln claimed he most assuredly was, then it was a total destruction of self-government to propose that he be governed by a master without his consent. Allowing slavery to spread forced the American people into an open war with the Declaration of Independence, depriving our republican example of its just influence in the world. By appealing to the moral and philosophical foundation work of the nation, Lincoln hoped to provide common ground on which good men in both the North and the South could stand. I am not now combating the argument of necessity, arising from the fact that the blacks are already amongst us, but I am combating what is set up as moral argument for allowing them to be taken where they have never yet been. Unlike the majority of anti-slavery orators, who denounced the South and castigated slave owners as corrupt and unchristian, Lincoln pointedly denied fundamental differences between Northerners and Southerners. He argued that they are just what we would be in their situation. If slavery did not now exist amongst them, they would not introduce it. If it did now exist amongst us, we should not instantly give it up. When it is said that the institution exists, and that it is very difficult to get rid of it in any satisfactory way, I can understand and appreciate the saying. I surely will not blame them for not doing what I should not know how to do myself. And finally, when they remind us of their constitutional rights, I acknowledge them, and I would give them any legislation for the reclaiming of their fugitives. Rather than upbraid slave owners, Lincoln sought to comprehend their position through empathy. More than a decade earlier, he had employed a similar approach when he advised temperance advocates to refrain from denouncing drinkers in thundering tones of anathema and denunciation, for denunciation would inevitably be met with denunciation, crimination with crimination, and anathema with anathema. In a passage directed at abolitionists as well as temperance reformers, he had observed that it was the nature of man, when told that he should be shunned and despised, and condemned as the author of all the vice and misery and crime in the land, to retreat within himself, close all the avenues to his head and his heart. Though the cause be naked truth itself, transformed to the heaviest lance, harder than steel, the sanctimonious reformer could no more pierce the heart of the drinker or the slave owner than penetrate the hard shell of a tortoise with a rye straw. Such is man, and so must he be understood by those who would lead him. In order to win a man to your cause, Lincoln explained, you must first reach his heart, the great high road to his reason. This, he concluded, was the only road to victory, to that glorious day when there shall be neither a slave nor a drunkard on the earth. Building on his rhetorical advice, Lincoln tried to place himself in the shoes of the slave owner, to reason his way through the sectional impasse, by asking Southerners to let their own hearts and history reveal that they, too, recognized the basic humanity of the black man. Never appealing, like Seward, to a higher law, or resorting to Chase's natural right, derived from the code of heaven, Lincoln staked his argument in reality. He confronted Southerners with the contradictions surrounding the legal status of blacks that existed in their own laws and social practices. In 1820, he reminded them, they had joined the North almost unanimously in declaring the African slave trade piracy and in annexing to it the punishment of death. In so doing, they must have understood that selling slaves was wrong, for they never thought of hanging men for selling horses, buffaloes, or bears. Likewise, though forced to do business with the domestic slave dealer, they did not recognize him as a friend or even as an honest man. Now, why is this? He asked. You do not so treat the man who deals in corn, cattle, or tobacco. Finally, he observed, over 400,000 free blacks in the United States had been liberated at vast pecuniary sacrifices by white owners who understood something about the human rights of Negroes. In all these cases, it is your sense of justice and human sympathy continually telling you that the slave is a man who cannot be considered mere merchandise. As he wound to a close, Lincoln implored his audience to readopt the Declaration of Independence and return slavery to the position our fathers gave it, and there let it rest in peace. This accomplishment, he pledged, would save the Union, and succeeding millions of free, happy people the world over shall rise up and call us blessed to the latest generations. When he finished, the enthusiastic audience broke out in deafening applause. Even the editors of the Democratic paper felt compelled to say that they had never read or heard a stronger anti-Nebraska speech. From that moment on, propelled by a renewed sense of purpose, Lincoln dedicated the major part of his energies to the anti-slavery movement. Conservative and contemplative by temperament, he embraced new positions warily. Once he committed himself, however, as he did in the mid-50s to the anti-slavery cause, he demonstrated singular tenacity and authenticity of feeling. Ambition and conviction united. "As my two eyes make one in sight," as Robert Frost wrote, to give Lincoln both a political future and a cause worthy of his era. Chapter 6. The Gathering Storm. As 1854 gave way to 1855, Abraham Lincoln's long-dormant dream of high political office was reawakened, now infused with a new sense of purpose by the passage of the Nebraska Act. He won a seat in the Illinois State Assembly, then promptly declared himself a candidate for the U.S. Senate. In the Illinois state elections the previous fall, the loose coalition of anti-slavery Whigs and independent Democrats had gained a narrow majority over the Douglas Democrats in the legislature. The victory was mainly attributed to Lincoln's leadership, observed state legislator Joseph Gillespie. With the new legislature set to convene in late January to choose the next U.S. senator from Illinois, Lincoln was the first choice of the overwhelming majority of anti-Nebraska members. His lifelong dream of achieving high political office seemed about to be realized at last. On January 20, 1855, however, the worst blizzard in more than two decades isolated Springfield from the rest of the state, preventing a quorum from assembling in the state legislature. Immense snowdrifts cut off trains coming in from the north, and mail was halted for more than a week. While Springfield's children relished the merry sleigh bells jingling through the snow, the pulsation of business was nearly extinct. Finally, the weather improved sufficiently for the legislature to convene. On Thursday morning, February 8th, long before the balloting opened at 3 o'clock, the Capitol was a beehive of activity. Representatives caucused and whispered in every corner. The anti-Nebraska caucus, composed mainly of Whigs, voted, as expected, to support Lincoln. But a small group of 5 anti-Nebraska Democrats was ominously absent. The Douglas Democrats, meanwhile, had decided to support the incumbent senator, James Shields, on the early ballots. If Shields's campaign faltered due to his outspoken endorsement of the Nebraska bill, they had devised a plan to switch their support to the popular Democratic governor, Joel Matteson, who had not taken an open position on the bill. In this way, the Democrats believed they might win over some members of the anti-Nebraska caucus. By noon, the lobby and the galleries of the Hall of the House of Representatives began to fill with senators, representatives, and their guests. Notable among the ladies in the gallery were Mary Todd Lincoln and her friend Julia Jane Trumbull, wife of Democrat Lyman Trumbull, who had recently been elected to Congress on an anti-Nebraska platform. The wife and daughter of Governor Madison were also in attendance. Some weeks earlier, Lincoln had bought a stack of small notebooks to record, with Mary's help, all 100 members of the two houses, identifying the party affiliation of each, as well as his stance on the Nebraska bill. Their calculations gave reason to hope, but the situation was complicated. To reach a majority of 51 votes, Lincoln would have to hold together the fragile coalition comprised of former rivals in the Whig and Democratic camps who had only recently joined hands against the Nebraska bill. Led by the governor, the senators marched into the House chamber at the appointed hour. When all were sworn in, the balloting began. On the first ballot, Lincoln received 45 votes, against 41 for the Douglas Democrat James Shields, and 5 for Congressman Lyman Trumbull. The 5 anti-Nebraska Democrats who voted for Trumbull were led by Norman Judd of Chicago. They had no personal animosity toward Lincoln, but having been elected as Democrats, they could not sustain themselves at home, they claimed, if they voted for a Whig for senator. In the ballots that followed, as daylight gave way to gaslights in the Great Hall, Lincoln reached a high point of 47 votes, only 4 shy of victory. Nonetheless, the little Trumbull coalition refused to budge, denying Lincoln the necessary majority. Finally, after 9 ballots, Lincoln concluded that unless his supporters shifted to Trumbull, the Douglas Democrats, who had, as expected, switched their allegiance to Madison, would choose the next senator. Unwilling to sacrifice all the hard work of the anti-slavery coalition, Lincoln advised his floor manager, Stephen Logan, to drop him for Trumbull. Logan refused at first, protesting the injustice of the candidate with the much larger vote giving in to the candidate with the smaller vote. Lincoln was adamant, insisting that if his name remained on the ballot, "You will lose both Trumbull and myself, and I think the cause, in this case, is to be preferred to men." When Logan rose to speak, the tension in the chamber was so great that the spectators scarcely breathed. In a sad voice, he announced that it was the purpose of the remaining Whigs to decide the contest. Obeying his directions, Lincoln's supporters switched their votes to Trumbull, giving him the 51 votes needed for victory. Lincoln's friends were inconsolable, believing that this was perhaps his last chance for that high position. Logan put his hands over his face and began to cry, while Davis stormily announced that had he been in Lincoln's situation, he never would have consented to the 47 men being controlled by the 5. In public, Lincoln expressed no hard feelings toward either Trumbull or Judd. He deliberately showed up at Trumbull's victory party, with a smile on his face and a warm handshake for the victor. Consoled that the Nebraska men were worse whipped than he, Lincoln insisted that Madison's defeat gives me more pleasure than my own gives me pain. On the whole, it is perhaps as well for our general cause that Trumbull is elected. Lincoln's magnanimity served him well. While Seward and Chase would lose friends in victory, Seward by neglecting at the height of his success his old friend Horace Greeley, and Chase by not understanding the lingering resentments that followed in the wake of his 1849 Senate victory, Lincoln, in defeat, gained friends. Neither Trumbull nor Judd would ever forget Lincoln's generous behavior. Indeed, both men would assist him in his bid for the U.S. Senate in 1858, and Judd would play a critical role in his run for the presidency in 1860. Mary Lincoln was unable to be so gracious. Convinced that Trumbull had acted with cold, selfish treachery, she never spoke another word to Trumbull's wife, Julia, who had been a bridesmaid at her wedding and one of her closest friends. Though intermediaries tried in succeeding years to bring the two women together, the ruptured friendship never healed. neither could Mary forgive Norman Judd for his role in supporting Trumbull. Though Judd, along with Davis, would do more than anyone else to assure Lincoln's nomination at the Chicago Convention, Mary did everything she could to blackball him from a cabinet post after her husband's election. Despite the dignity of Lincoln's public demeanor, he privately suffered a brutal disappointment, describing the ordeal as an agony. Though he had engineered Trumbull's victory for the sake of the anti-Nebraska cause, it was difficult to accept the manner of his loss. He could bear defeat inflicted by his enemies with a pretty good grace, he told his friend Gillespie, but it was hard to be wounded in the house of his friends. After all the hard work, the interminable nights and weekends on the hustings, the conversations with fellow politicians, the hours spent writing letters to garner support, after so many years of patient waiting and hopefulness, he seemed as far from realizing his ambition as ever. Fate seemed to take a curious delight in finding new ways to shatter his dreams. In the summer of 1855, disappointment piled upon disappointment. 6 months after his loss to Trumbull, Lincoln's involvement in a celebrated law case forced him to recognize that his legal reputation, secure as it might have been in frontier Illinois, carried little weight among the preeminent lawyers in the country. The story began that June with the arrival in Springfield of Peter Watson, a young associate in the distinguished Philadelphia firm headed by George Harding, a nationally renowned patent specialist. Harding had been hired by the John Manny Company of Rockford, Illinois, to defend its mechanical reaping machine against a patent infringement charge brought by Cyrus McCormick, the original inventor of the reaper. McCormick versus Manny, better known as the Reaper suit, was considered an important test case, pitting two outstanding patent lawyers, Edward Dickerson of New York and former Attorney General Reverdy Johnson for McCormick, against Harding for Manny. Since the case was to be tried before a judge in Chicago, Harding decided to engage a local lawyer who understood the judge and had his confidence, though from his eastern perspective he condescendingly expressed doubt he could find a lawyer in Illinois who would be of real assistance in arguing the case. Watson was sent to Springfield to see if Abraham Lincoln, whose name had been recommended, was the right man for the position. His initial impression was not positive. Neither the small frame house on 8th Street, nor Lincoln's appearance at the door with neither coat nor vest, indicated a lawyer of sufficient standing for a case of this magnitude. After talking with Lincoln, however, Watson decided he might be rather effective after all. He paid Lincoln a retainer and arranged a substantial fee when the work was completed. Lincoln was thrilled with both the fee and the opportunity to test himself with the renowned Reverdy Johnson. He began working on the legal arguments for the case, understanding that Harding would present the scientific arguments. Not long after Watson's Springfield visit, Harding received word that the case had been transferred from Chicago to Cincinnati. The change of venue to Ohio removed the one object for employing Lincoln, allowing Harding to team up with the man he had wanted in the first place, the brilliant Edwin Stanton. Unaware of the changed situation, Lincoln continued to develop his case. "At our interview here in June," he wrote Watson in late July, "I understood you to say you would send me copies of the bill and answer, and also of depositions. I have had nothing from you since. However, I attended the U.S. court at Chicago, and while there, got copies. I write this particularly to urge you to forward on to me the additional evidence as fast as you can. During August and the remainder of this month, I can devote some time to the case, and, of course, I want all the material that can be had. During my day at Chicago, I went out to Rockford and spent half a day examining and studying Manny's machine." Though Lincoln never heard from Watson, he pieced together what he needed, and in late September set out for Cincinnati with a lengthy brief in his hands. Arriving at the Burnett House, where all the lawyers were lodged, he encountered Harding and Stanton as they left for the court. Years later, Harding could still recall the shock of his first sight of the tall, rawly boned, ungainly backwoodsman with coarse, ill-fitting clothing, his trousers hardly reaching his ankles, holding in his hands a blue cotton umbrella with a ball on the end of the handle. Lincoln introduced himself and proposed, "Let's go up in a gang." At this point, Stanton drew Harding aside and whispered, "Why did you bring that damned long-armed ape here? He does not know anything and can do you no good." With that, Stanton and Harding turned from Lincoln and continued to court on their own. In the days that followed, Stanton managed to make it plain to Lincoln that he was expected to remove himself from the case. Lincoln did withdraw, though he remained in Cincinnati to hear the arguments. Harding never opened Lincoln's manuscript, so sure that it would be only trash. Throughout that week, though Lincoln ate at the same hotel, Harding and Stanton never asked him to join them for a meal or accompany them to or from court. When Judge John McLean hosted a dinner for the lawyers on both sides, Lincoln was not invited. The hearing continued for a week. The sophisticated arguments were a revelation to Lincoln, recalled Ralph Emerson, one of Manny's partners. So intrigued was he by Stanton's speech in particular that he stood in rapt attention, drinking in his words. Never before, Emerson realized, had Lincoln seen anything so finished and elaborated and so thoroughly prepared. When the hearing was over, Lincoln told Emerson that he was going home to study law. Emerson did not understand at first what Lincoln meant by this, but Lincoln explained, "For any rough-and-tumble case, and a pretty good one, too, I am enough for any man we have out in that country. But these college-trained men are coming west. They have had all the advantages of a lifelong training in the law, plenty of time to study, and everything, perhaps, to fit them. Soon they will be in Illinois. And when they appear, I will be ready." As Lincoln prepared to leave Cincinnati, he went to say goodbye to William Dixon, one of the few people who had shown him kindness that week. "You have made my stay here most agreeable, and I am 1,000 times obliged to you," Lincoln told Dixon's wife. "But in reply to your request for me to come again, I must say to you I never expect to be in Cincinnati again. I have nothing against the city, but things have so happened here as to make it undesirable for me ever to return here." After returning to Springfield, Lincoln received a check in the mail for the balance of his fee. He returned it, saying he had not earned it, never having made any argument. When Watson sent the check a second time, Lincoln cashed it. Unimaginable as it might seem, after Stanton's bearish behavior, at their next encounter 6 years later, Lincoln would offer Stanton the most powerful civilian post within his gift, the post of Secretary of War. Lincoln's choice of Stanton would reveal, as would his subsequent dealings with Trumbull and Judd, a singular ability to transcend personal vendetta, humiliation, or bitterness. As for Stanton, despite his initial contempt for the long-armed ape, he would not only accept the offer, but come to respect and love Lincoln more than any person outside of his immediate family. Stanton's surly condescension toward Lincoln must be considered in the context of his anxiety over the Reaper trial, which had assumed crucial importance for him. Ever since the death of his father, when he was only 13, Stanton had been obsessed with financial security. Until his father, a successful physician, died from apoplexy at the age of 40, young Edwin had led a pampered existence in Steubenville, Ohio, surrounded by a loving family in a stately two-story brick house with a large yard and fruitful garden. Taught to read when he was only 3 years old, the precocious child had ready access to his father's large collection of books and received an excellent education at the old academy in Steubenville. But when his father died, leaving no estate, Edwin was forced to leave school to help support his widowed mother and three younger siblings. First came the forced sale of the house, then the sale of his father's library, and finally the necessity to move to much smaller quarters. Apprenticed to a bookseller, Stanton read books in every spare moment he could find, and spent his evenings preparing for entrance to nearby Kenyon College, headed by Chase's uncle, Philander. An excellent student, he enjoyed two happy years at Kenyon before his family's scarce resources required that he return to work, this time in a Columbus bookstore. The following year, Stanton returned to Steubenville and secured an apprenticeship in a law office, where he simultaneously studied law and helped his mother with the younger children. In later years, his adoring sister, Pamphila, recalled Stanton's critical role in anchoring the entire family, tenderly nursing his ailing mother, sending his brother Darwin to Harvard Medical School, and encouraging his younger sisters to memorize dozens of poems by Byron and Whittier, all the while reading Plutarch's Lives and other works of history. Success in the law came quickly, the result of an intuitive mind, a prodigious capacity for work, and a forceful courtroom manner. When he fell in love with Mary Lamson, he enjoyed what he much later called the happiest hours of his life. A marvelously intellectual young woman, Mary shared his passion for reading and study, coupled with a feminist determination that women could regenerate the world if only they were rightly educated. When their marriage produced a daughter, Lucy, and a son, Edwin Jr., Stanton had every reason to believe that fortune was smiling on him. His sister Pamphila later recalled that her brother seemed perpetually bright and cheery. As his practice grew, he had the means not only to take care of his own family, but to provide for his mother and younger siblings as well. Stanton looked upon Mary as his life companion. They both loved history, literature, and poetry. Together they read Gibbon, Carlyle, Macaulay, Madame de Stael, Samuel Johnson, Bancroft, and Byron. "We years ago were lovers," he wrote her after the children were born. "We are now parents. A new relation has taken place. The love of our offspring has opened up fresh fountains of love for each other. We look forward now to life, not for ourselves only, but for our children. I loved you for your beauty and grace and loveliness of your person. I love you now for the richness and surpassing excellence of your mind. One love has not taken the place of the other, but both stand side by side. I love you now with a fervor and truth of affection which speech cannot express." His happiness was short-lived. His daughter, Lucy, died after an attack of scarlet fever. 3 years later, in March 1844, his beloved Mary developed a fatal bilious fever and died at the age of 29. Stanton was so broken-hearted, his grief verged on insanity. Before he would allow her burial, he had a seamstress fashion a wedding dress for her. "She is my bride, and shall be dressed and buried like a bride." After the funeral, he could not bring himself to work for months. Since he was involved in almost every case that came before the court in Jefferson County, Ohio, no court was held that spring. For months, he laid out Mary's nightcap and gown on her pillow. His sister, Pamphila, who had come to stay with him, would never forget the horror of the long nights when, with lamp in hand, he searched for Mary through every room of the house, with sobs and tears streaming from his eyes, screaming over and over, "Where is Mary?" Stanton's responsibilities to his family eventually brought him back to his law practice, but he could not let go of his sorrow. Fearful that his son, then only 2 years old, would have no memories of the mother he had lost, he spent his nights writing a letter of over 100 pages to the boy. He described his romance with Mary from its earliest days, and included extracts from all the letters they had exchanged over the years. His words were penned with an unsteady hand, he confessed, with tears obscuring his vision, and an anguish of heart driving him periodically from his chair. He would have preferred to wait until the boy was older and better able to understand, but time, care, sickness, and the vicissitudes of life wear out and efface the impression of the mind. Besides, life is uncertain. I may be called from you. You might live and die without knowing of the affection your father and mother bore for you and for each other. Stanton's miseries multiplied when his younger brother Darwin, who completed his studies at Harvard Medical School, developed a high fever that impaired his brain. Unhinged by his acute illness, the young doctor, who was married with 3 small children, took a sharp lance head and punctured his throat. He bled to death in a few moments, a family friend recalled. His mother watched helplessly as the blood spouted up to the ceiling. Neighbors were sent to fetch Edwin, who lived nearby. When he witnessed the aftermath of the gruesome spectacle, he reportedly lost self-control and wandered off into the woods without his hat or coat. Fearful that he, too, might commit suicide, neighbors pursued, restrained, and escorted him home, where they took turns watching over him. This horrific train of events transformed Stanton's spirit. His natural ebullience faded. Where formerly he met everybody with hearty and cheerful greeting, said a friend, he now moved about in silence and gloom, with head bowed and hands clasped behind. Though he remained a tender father to his son and a loving brother to his younger sisters, he became increasingly aggressive in court, intimidating witnesses unnecessarily, antagonizing fellow lawyers, exhibiting rude and irascible behavior. He derived his only satisfaction from his growing reputation and his increasing wealth, which allowed him to care for his son, his widowed mother, his sisters, and his dead brother's wife and children. The Reaper case was the biggest case of his career, the most important patent cause that has ever been tried, he told a friend, and more time, labor, money, and brains have been expended in getting it ready for argument than any other patent case ever has had bestowed upon it. If all went well, it would open doors for Stanton at the highest level of his profession. When he arrived at the Burnett house, he discovered that Harding had been unwell for several days and might not be in a position to go to court. Terrified that in addition to the legal argument he had fully prepared, he might now have to present the scientific part of the case, to which he had given no attention, Stanton stayed up all night in preparation. He was greatly relieved when Harding recovered, but anxiety and lack of sleep compounded the irascibility that had marked his demeanor since the multiple deaths in his family. Beyond the breaking pressures of the case, Stanton had become involved in a turbulent courtship. The young woman, Ellen Hutchison, the daughter of a wealthy Pittsburgh businessman, was the first woman who had attracted his interest since the death of his wife more than a decade earlier. Tall, blonde, and blue-eyed, Ellen was, by Stanton's description, radiant with beauty and intellect. While Stanton was smitten with Ellen immediately, she was slow to respond to his affections. She still suffered from a romantic disappointment that had left her heart in agony and convinced her that she could not love again. Stanton understood, he told her, that the trouble of early love fell like a killing frost upon the tree of your life, but he was confident that enough life still remains to put forth fresh blossoms. Despite his encouragement, Ellen was vexed by some of the qualities others noted in Stanton: his obsessive concentration on work, his impatience and lack of humor, and, most worrisome, his carelessness and indifference to the feelings of all. Addressing these concerns, Stanton admitted that there is so much of the hard and repulsive in my, I will not say nature, for that, I think, is soft and tender, but in the temper and habit of life generated by adverse circumstances, that great love only can bear with and overlook. If the last decade of his life had been different, he assured her, if he had been blessed with the companionship of a woman whose love would have pointed out and kindly corrected my errors, I would have escaped the fault you condemn. After the successful conclusion of the Reaper trial, Ellen was finally persuaded to marry Edwin on June 25, 1856. Happier years followed for Stanton. The Manny patent was sustained, not only by the Cincinnati court, but by the U.S. Supreme Court on appeal. With this huge victory behind him, Stanton moved his practice to Washington, D.C., where he argued important cases before the Supreme Court, achieved substantial financial security, and built a brick mansion for his new wife. As Lincoln's own hopes were repeatedly frustrated, he wistfully watched the progress of others, in particular Stephen Douglas, his great rival, with whom he had often debated around the fire of Speed's general store. 22 years ago, Judge Douglas and I first became acquainted, he confided in a private fragment later discovered in his papers. We were both young then, he a trifle younger than I. Even then we were both ambitious, I perhaps quite as much so as he. With me, the race of ambition has been a failure, a flat failure. With him, it has been one of splendid success. His name fills the nation, and is not unknown even in foreign lands. I affect no contempt for the high eminence he has reached, so reached that the oppressed of my species might have shared with me in the elevation. I would rather stand on that eminence than wear the richest crown that ever pressed a monarch's brow. At this juncture, some have suggested, Lincoln was sustained by his wife's unflagging belief that a glorious destiny awaited him. She had the fire, will, and ambition, his law partner John Stuart observed. When Mary was young and still being courted by many beaux, she had told a friend who had taken an old, wealthy husband, I would rather marry a good man, a man of mind, with a hope and bright prospects ahead for position, fame, and power, than to marry all the houses, gold, and bones in the world. Stephen Douglas, who had been among her suitors, she considered a very little, little giant by the side of my tall Kentuckian